Our lesson tonight is not a continuation of our series. We're done. This is actually one I've thought about doing for a long time. I didn't know I was going to be speaking tonight. I wasn't sure. I thought it might. I wasn't sure. It's fine. I've long told whoever preached at the congregation that I'm happy to stand in at the last minute. I have a strangely recurring dream where I'm asked to stand up and preach or no one has shown up. A little bit almost like what happened to, I guess, Eric on Wednesday, right, where he got to pinch hit. All of a sudden, we had a small hiccup and miscommunication in our scheduling system. And so that was, I think, a little exciting. I have thought about for a long time the idea of sitting there and then all of a sudden there's no preacher looking around and trying to get up and just pinch hit in a situation like that. And in a way, this is the lesson I thought about doing for that. So now I'll have to think up another lesson. Although this wasn't just a complete pinch hit. I did find out this afternoon, and I thought I might have to. So this has been running through my mind anyway, but we'll have to see how it goes because I didn't prepare as much as I usually do for these. If I start off and say, in the beginning, well, where am I? Okay, so at that point, you don't really know yet, do you? That will become important a little bit later. But let's start at the very beginning, right? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There's a lot going on right there at the start. And there's a lot that we learn, even in the first few words. We learn in the beginning that there is a beginning. That is a profound metaphysical, philosophical statement that has troubled humanity for millennia. Aristotle, for example, believed that the earth was eternal, and so was the universe. And oddly enough, science has gone back and forth and back and forth on this, and you have cosmologists that are arguing all the time about, is there a beginning? Is there an end? Is there going to be an end? Does the heat death of the universe really result in an end? Is there another beginning? And all this obsession goes on and on. So already we have this concept of in the beginning, but we see something profound right here at the start of the Bible, and it's something that is difficult for us moderns to deal with, although because it might make us a little bit uncomfortable. If I were to instead start the Bible by saying, once upon a time, you would be a little put off because you would think, you're trying to tell me a story. And this isn't a story, Justin, this is truth. It's a strange dichotomy that's happened in our culture in the last, say, few hundred years. And it's only now beginning to shift again to another kind of thing. And we're a part of that. I tell my class this quite a bit. The generations are slowly shifting and moving, or actually, I guess you could say rapidly shifting and moving, but what is happening is that we're in a fulcrum point of belief and culture and sociology and the way that we view things. And so this is profound, and it has really profound implications for the way we think, and especially the way we think about someone who says, in the beginning, and is making an authoritative statement about something. In 1979, the French government asked a philosopher named Jean-François Lyotard to write up a report on what on earth was going on in the world with regard to science and with all this new movement of something that seemed to be on the march. And he wrote a book called The Postmodern Condition. Little tiny book, but a bit painful to read, considering that it combined a government report with the philosopher. Seems like a bad plan. And it kind of reads that way sometimes. But in the very introductory part of his book, he makes a statement that has kind of profound implications, in which if you think about it, sticks in your mind. He says that he defined postmodernism, and in those days that was a very new term, he defined postmodernism as an incredulity toward metanarratives. So that's a long way of saying, I don't believe there's a master plan. Or if someone comes up to you and says, I know what the master plan is, you don't believe them. Now you might say, well, I do because I'm a Christian. Or I do because I believe in some science thing. Or I do because of these other things. But what Lyotard was describing, and I mentioned that it was a government report, because he was not describing the way he thought things ought to be. He was describing the way things were becoming. But he said something else interesting in the book that's always stuck with me, which is that narratives carry within themselves their own truth claim. What does he mean by that? He means what the Bible does. The Bible doesn't justify Genesis 1:1. The Bible just begins with Genesis 1:1. It lays it there for you, and although it might make us uncomfortable to say it, you will either have faith in it or you will not. Now, you might do a lot of research, and you might find reasonable reasons to believe that that's okay, and that's all right. But in the end of the day, the Bible doesn't ask you to give reasonable reasons for it. It just says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Mic drop. And that's all you get. It doesn't say, in the beginning, there was molecules and quantum physics and light, and there was a Big Bang, and there's a cosmology and cosmological constants, something you'll understand someday, and wave physics. And no, he doesn't do all these nonsensical things. He doesn't go down the path of Aristotle either. I mean, it's not like this is fairly recent, this idea of trying to find and figure out whether or not you need a creator. I mean, Aristotle wasn't a Christian, wasn't a Jew, yet he's trying to figure out whether or not an uncaused cause is necessary at the beginning of a universe. And so, you know, but the Bible doesn't even do that. It's a narrative, and because of that, it contains its own truth claim embedded in it. It delivers it there for you. Take it or leave it. And so what we have is, in the beginning, what? God created the heavens and the earth. And so it asserts several things. Number one, that there is a beginning. But number two, that God was already present at that beginning. He's already there. Already we have something, a story building. We say in the beginning, and then there's a character, but the character's already in the room. And so he is the one who gives birth to it. He creates. This verse, of course, has been an obsession, and rightfully so, for the Jews for thousands of years since it was written. And they have obsessed over it and thought about it and been twisted in little circles around it, down to its syllables and its letters. Their own mystical tradition of Kabbalah becomes like twisted in and out of these circles about the letters that make up the first verse of Genesis, and trying to build entire theologies out of them. And so the Jews have become obsessed with this. And I say that to lead into the fact that when I first started this off, I said in the beginning and asked you where I was, and you didn't know. And the reason was is because there's another in the beginning in the Bible. So you don't know where I'm going to go with it. And I say that because the Jews were the same way. And so when John begins in John chapter 1, and he says in arche, okay, so the Greek for in the beginning, every Jew's ear would be perked up, because the Septuagint for Genesis 1:1 would also say in arche. And they would say, what is he going to tell us? In arche what? And John would say, in arche ein halagas. In the beginning was the Word. Strange thing to say. It sounds a little more strange. This is a weird thing for me to tell you. It sounds a little more weird to us than it would have sounded to them. And by them, I don't mean just the Jews. I mean also the Greeks as well. Because it turns out that there was in vogue at the time the idea that this motive force called the Logos was the creative engine and entity behind the universe. And Greek philosophy had actually said that now for hundreds of years, back to a pre-Socratic named Heraclitus, who actually first says the Logos is what is the generative force for the universe. And he says, though, it's impersonal. It's this impersonal force. The Greeks loved impersonal forces for the beginning of the universe. And so a Greek would read this, and they would maybe say, you know, a Greek could open their Bible, if you would, and look at John's letter, and they would be intrigued. They would say, in the beginning was the Word. Yeah, I got that. It turns out the Greek thought had also infected Jewish thought. And of course, there's a famous Jew named Philo of Alexandria. And he, of course, being in Alexandria, northern Africa, being in a very cosmopolitan area of the Roman Empire, he'd interfaced a lot with Greek philosophy. And so he's writing, you know, just before, he's writing in 50 to 30 BC. And so he comes along and he basically also becomes obsessed with the idea of the Logos as it relates to God now. So he ties it back into the Bible. The interesting thing is that he does this and partially bases it on a chapter of the Bible, which would also become very important for early Christians. I want to read this to you, but I'd like you to read along from your versions as well. Proverbs 8, starting in verse 22. I hope you might find this part interesting. This is going to be out of the Septuagint, okay? What I'm going to be reading. Read along with me, though. You'll see some kind of noticeable differences in what you read. So Proverbs 8, verse 22 is where we're going to start. If I declare to you the things that happen daily, I will also remember to recount the things of old. The Lord created me in the beginning of his ways for his works. He established me in the beginning before time, before he made the earth and before he made the abysses, before the going forth of the fountains of waters, before the mountains were created. And he begot me before all hills. The Lord made the fields and the uninhabited places and the inhabited heights under heaven. When he prepared heaven, I was present with him. And when he set apart his throne upon the winds, when he made strong the things above the clouds, and made sure the fountains under heaven, and made strong the foundations of the earth, I was working beside him. I was he in whom he rejoiced. Daily and continually, I was gladdened by his face. When he completed the world, he rejoiced, and he rejoiced in the sons of men. Now therefore, my son, hear me. Blessed is the man who shall hearken to me, and the man who shall guard my ways, who watches daily at my doors, who keeps watch at the doors of my entryways. For my issues are the issues of life, and grace is prepared from the Lord. But those who sin against me act ungodly toward their own souls, and those who hate me love death. Now, I didn't start at the very beginning of the chapter, but who's talking? Wisdom. So in Proverbs, wisdom becomes personified. But I took the opportunity to emphasize, by the sound of my voice, hopefully, a few kind of interesting quirks that the Septuagint has. I like the part where it says, I was he in whom he rejoiced. There were odd quirks in this passage that set off folks like Philo of Alexandria to say, there's something more personal and more eternal and something strange about this passage. And in fact, Christians would use this passage from the Septuagint to argue with Jews for 500 years after the first century, because they would say, that is Christ right there. That is Christ being described. We don't do that so much because our Bibles don't quite personify wisdom as much in that passage as the Septuagint does. If you listen to the way the Septuagint does it, wisdom comes across as a person, as an entity who is a thinking person, part of the creative process, but also there before time. And you even have the word begat. He begat me before time began. So there is this linkage that happens even in books like we see and which John emphasizes in John 1:1. Now, if you can, I'm cheating because I brought my iPad with me, and I split my screen into two. I want to look really quick here before I close at Genesis 1 and John 1 and look at the two of these together, because the person, remember, that saw in arche ein halagos, right? The Greek who sees that says, yeah, okay, I'm all right. In the beginning was the Logos. Sure, I understand that. That's Heraclitus. That's Greek philosophy 101. The Jew that saw it would say, yeah, all right, Philo of Alexandria. Yeah, we got a good thing going on here. We might agree. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. All right, and the Word was God. A little more uncomfortable there. But the Greek might be, absolutely. Remember that this sounds almost like Heraclitus would be talking to you. Absolutely. But Heraclitus would say what about God? He would say that God is not a personality. He would say, absolutely, the Logos is God, but Logos as an impersonal force. And now we run into something that gives the Greek trouble. He was in the beginning with God. But yet you can see the link there, right? Back to the Septuagint form of Proverbs 8. He was in the beginning with God. It was he in whom God himself took pleasure. And so the Jew at this point in time, if he or she's indoctrinated in Philo of Alexandria, is still thinking that John is talking to them, and they're still probably agreeing with him all right. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. So far, so good. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Now, notice that here between both Genesis and John, we have these linkages that have begun to take place, right? Both of them have in the beginning. That's not an accident. John did that on purpose. And no Jewish reader would have seen it as an accident. They would have said, you are claiming something for this word, and you're claiming godhood for this word. The whole book of John has what we call a high Christology. By that, it means you cannot read the book of John and mistake it for not saying that Jesus is God. You have to change it like the Jehovah's Witnesses do in their own translation if you hope to escape from what it says to you. And so it says, all things were made through him. Without him was not anything made that was made. Life, and life was the light of men. What's the first thing that God makes? And God said, notice that he speaks it. Speak, logos, word, speaks. God's voice and the things he says have creative power. The frame to understand about God is that there's no separation in God between creation and what he says and what he wills and what takes place. These things are fused in God into one. We humans can lie. I can say to you, I'm going to do this thing, and I can not do it. That happens all the time. Whether or not I do it accidentally or not, I will have forgotten something. This happens to me several times, right? I said I was going to be there. Oh, I forgot all about that. This is not the way God works. If God says something, it is as though it has already taken place. And so that's why God's speech act itself is the creating force of the universe. Okay? He says, let there be light. There's nothing else in Genesis 1. There's no burst of imaginary power. There's no thing that comes out that looks like an Avenger has done some great thing. There's no thing like this, right? There is merely, and God said, let there be light. And there was light, because he's God. And when he says things, they take place. Going back to John 1:1, it says, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. John does this on purpose. This light he's talking about here is not the light that God created, though, at that point in time, although he links it back to the creation story. He's talking about a spiritual light at this point, isn't he? But he's linking it back and making it ancient and making it powerful. He's linking it back to that creation narrative. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. I would submit to you, by the way, I know that some of you know about this weird theory of mine, and maybe eventually I'll get around to putting together a whole class around it, that John is obsessed with water, spirit, and with water, spirit, and blood. And so in 1 John, when we see that these three things are the witnesses, I have a belief that you can go through the book of John and it ties water, spirit, and blood together over and over again in these sort of metaphorical circles. One of these days I'll put all that together. Tim wants me to do it, but I just haven't actually sat down and done it. But I believe when you see John come into the narrative, everybody who knew about John and what John was would have seen this as the entrance of water into the narrative, because he's John the what? The Baptist. Right? And so, you know, Mark, when he starts off the gospel, what does the gospel of Mark start with? The gospel of Mark doesn't start with the birth of Jesus. The gospel of Mark starts with the baptism of Jesus. So I think that John, at this point, is basically introducing water, which has already come in Genesis 1, right? Water. Water comes in. Water is original. And in fact, what we see is that that phrase that Peter said, water was what the first world was made out of, and water was by which it was destroyed in the flood. Water becomes this profound thing throughout the Bible. And in fact, it is even for us Christians today with baptism. The light shines. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him. At this point, both the Jew and the Greek of the first century would have their mind shattered by that. Because now, John says, this motive force, this thing that the Greek has identified as the Logos, as the creative force and power behind all the universe, and this thing that the Jew himself has looked at and obsessed over, this word, this wisdom, this personification of everything that is the spoken word of God, which is his power. Now, John says, that thing came into this world as a human. That thing penetrated into our reality, into our history. This is one of the things about Christianity that sets it apart, it and Judaism actually, set them both apart from other religions of the world in that they claim that historical events have taken place. This is something that has greatly bothered people throughout the years who have believed that someone has, for example, disproved, you know, some Bible event. And there's been several reactions to that. Usually someone says, well, you haven't, or someone says, look at this other evidence. But one reaction to this, oddly enough, especially among German theologians in the 19th century, was to create two whole versions of history and then say, this one's the spiritual history, and it's what the Bible describes, and everything else is the physical history. So if you find something in physical history that disagrees with the Bible, oh well, too bad, so sad, because the Bible has special spiritual history. They even had a name for these. One was Historie, and one was Geschichte. And so it's strange. They split this split. And all that was an attempt to try to protect the Bible from sort of science and people doing research. But you can't do that. We as Christians sort of live on the edge. We live on the edge of our religion having made a claim about realities occurring in actual history. If at any point, let's say after we died, if we can go back and look at the entire timeline, I have no idea if we'll ever be able to do anything. But let's say, for example, we moved out of time after you were dead, and God allowed you to go back and watch time like a television, right? Let's say this is a thing you could do. You would go back and there would be a man named Jesus, and he would walk through Galilee, and his feet would get dirty, and his apostles' feet would get dirty, and he would wash their feet, and he would be crucified, and he would die, and they would put him in a tomb, and then he would rise up again, and at some point he would rise up into the sky, and you would be able to see all that stuff actually happen in real life. Not as some sort of magical pseudo-history, but an actual no-kidding history. And this is the thing that frightens some people even of today who assume that at some point science might become powerful enough to be able to say that didn't happen with such a surety that a Christian would have to face it and give up. We as Christians believe, though, that it did. And that is a kind of fundamental difference between Christianity and Judaism versus other kinds of religion. Buddhism claims very little historical that you have to believe in. It's more a set of principles, for example. Same with things like Hinduism. They don't claim that you have to believe a given historical incident. But we Christians believe that a man came into this reality who was something special. And that special, according to John, was that he was the Logos, the creative power of God Almighty that is mentioned in Genesis 1:1 as the Word. And so he comes into this reality from the spiritual realm, from a realm of immense power. And he is a person who knows that he is capable of saying reality, of speaking reality. This is not like, I've mentioned this before, it's one of my themes in my class every so often, is that this is not like a superhero. This is not a superhuman. God is an entity other than you and me. He speaks reality. He says things and they become spun instantly into reality. And so imagine that that entity is suddenly born into the real world, into the world being spun as reality now. And so its creator, its very creator, comes to visit it. And this is John's whole point. He starts high. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. There was nothing that was made that was not made through him. And then that being, which the Greeks are like, wow, that's the Logos. Yeah, we know what that is. Jews who knew about Philo said, I know what that is. That's the personification of wisdom. That's the personification of God's power, his Word, the ability to speak in things into existence. That power becomes personified into our reality as you and me, flesh, something that can be killed, or at least attempt to be killed, didn't take, which of course is the other piece of humanity and another piece of Christianity that is important here. He was in the world, verse 10, he was in the world and the world was made through him. Yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, there's your blood, by the way, nor of the will of man, but of God. That's us. That's you. That's me. That's the body that I've talked about in the last three lessons. I'm going to close on that because I think it's a fantastic point of departure at the end of the lesson for an invitation. Notice how that birth that happens, which is us, you are the people that are being talked about there. That great power, that great entity that comes down into the world that decides, I have to do something about this. I am the Logos, but the Logos is a person. The Logos is a personality, unlike the Greek Logos. And so he comes down personified, becomes Jesus, becomes the Christ here, flesh, like you and like me. If he was sitting with us, if Isaiah is to be fully taken literally, maybe you wouldn't even recognize him. Maybe he would have come in and you would have just done one of these through the room and not even laid eyes on him. Maybe he wasn't anything special. Maybe he wasn't super handsome or anything. He just was a regular guy, fit right in, average height, average looks, everything. But yet that personification of ultimate power came to his own people and they didn't receive him. But to everyone who does receive him, that's you, he gave what? The right to become children of God. Now, later on, John is going to make a lot more out of that statement, okay? Children of God. But here he just kind of leaves it. And he says, these children are born not of blood. That is, they're not physical children of God. You're not born physically of God. You're not born of the will of the flesh. Okay, so you're not born because two people decided to come together and make you, all right? That's not why you're born. Nor at the will of man, you're not born from that will either, but you are born entirely because of God's will. And this is entirely because of you receiving him. Now the word receive here is, like all the words in John, as we close, not to be taken the same way as I mentioned John 3:16 is. This is a connotation word that ends up meaning much, 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 much more. John takes his words and he loads huge meaning into them. And really, English speakers have a huge problem with this because if we try to make this sort of sciencey thing out of John, then it's like, oh, receive Jesus into your heart. See, it says receive right there. That is ridiculous. What does it mean to receive the Logos? That means something a lot more profound than just, yes, I receive you into my heart. No, that's ridiculous. It's obviously a life-transforming experience. Do you remember when I talked this morning about identity? This is theoretically that point at which your identity shifts, at which your identity changes. The Logos, in meeting with you, shifts who you are. That's your receiving of him, is the change to your identity, to your very person. You become a child of God. If you are here this evening and you are not a child of God, or you became a child of God through some other means, know that there is a way that we are given that we become children of God. We belong to Him when we believe in His name, when we repent of our sins, when we confess His name, and when we are buried with Him in baptism and raised up out of the water, a new person, a new creation, born not of blood, not of the will of man, but of God at that point. And if you need that, would you come forward as we stand to sing the song that's been selected?